Audiobook of Sounds from Another Room by Peter Horsley, first published in Great Britain in 1997. Search PDF online, all link here. Foreword. Long introductions are tedious to reader and writer alike, so this foreword is short. My story is not the traditional saga of some minor military figure, it recounts a number of separate events, each true and of such intensity at the time that they altered the pattern of my life thereafter, like coral polyps shaping a reef. I like to compare it to a house whose main rooms are the events I shall describe and the corridors between, but the passage of time. The rooms themselves are of such variety they might have been designed by different architects and with each furnished in the style of its immediate tenants. There is a mystery about the house, for on occasions there would appear to be a house within a house, one living in the present, the other in a parallel time and dimension. The whispers and sounds of the other occupants sometimes break through from the recesses of a distant and unknown room, though message and messengers remain tantalizingly elusive. Both style and time may at times seem confusing, but there is a reason for this. Often early, I was a lonely child, often thrown back on my own resources and imagination. With no one close enough to whom I could reveal my innermost secrets, I became a compulsive scribbler, and remain one. So the book is a mixture of what I actually wrote at the time and what I have written since, from diaries and notes. For example, my school diaries are written exactly as they were at the time, and The Storm was written shortly after the event. Just 10 years ago I was involved in a very serious accident which, at the time, seemed to have been caused by some quite inexplicable malfunction of my car. As I lay at the roadside, not far from death, the whole story of my life passed in front of me, like a film that was madly out of control. A most remarkable explanation of the cause of that accident was later provided by Sir Ranulph Fenn in his book The Feather Men. It appears that I was the innocent tool of a terrorist gang who had decided to use my car as a murder weapon. A former officer in the Special Air Service, Sir Ranulph is very familiar with the shadowy world of terrorism, and I have no reason to challenge the facts as he gives them, even though several questions remain unanswered. As it was this extraordinary and devastating experience which triggered the idea behind this book of mine, he has very kindly allowed me to reproduce that story as my opening chapter. 1. The Clinic. It happened a long time ago in a far-off desert country. The four sons of Sheikh Ahmad bin Issa were killed in an ambush in the South Yemen by British forces. The Sheikh swore an oath of revenge on his sons' killers. The Clinic were a European gang of ruthless hired assassins who banded together to kill for money. The Sheikh finally met the leader of the gang in Dubai and took out a contract on his sons' killers, $1 million down payment, and a further $1 million for each of four films proving the assassinations. One stipulation of the contract was that the deaths were to appear accidental, arousing no suspicions of murder in the minds of relations or friends. The Feather Men were a British group, feather because their touch was light. They took into their grasp crimes which were beyond the powers of the ordinary police. The Feather Men relentlessly pursued the IRA in Northern Ireland, moving silently against those members who had escaped the hands of the law through lack of evidence. They also took under their wing the families of the SAS, Special Air Service, and established a body of watchdogs to look after their interests. The Feather Men were controlled by a committee of senior establishment figures under the chairmanship of Colonel Tommy McIntosh. So far the Clinic had fulfilled half their contract by arranging the deaths of Superintendent John Milling, a former Marine, and a police officer in the Omani Police Air Wing in a helicopter air accident by tampering with the pilot's collective control lever. After an unequal aerodynamic battle, the helicopter plunged into the sea, killing John Milling. They had then settled the fate of Major Mike Keeley, Special Air Service, who died of exposure in a climbing accident in the Brecon Beacons. He was leading a batch of SAS trainees on a forced march in atrocious weather conditions when he became separated from his charges. Keeley was then ambushed by the gang, who drugged him and left him to die on the mountain in the cold and swirling fog. Later on they would deal with Corporal Mac, the last of the four, and even attack Trunulf Fen himself close to his Exmoor farm. He was only rescued by the intervention of the Feathermen who had been watching the gang as they circled his farm. The clinic now turned their attention to Major Michael Marmon. They had broken into Marmon's Clapham home while he was out shopping and had photographed his diary. During their escape, however, they were recognized by a member of the Feathermen who had been watching their unlawful activities for some time. Mike Marmon was immediately warned that he was on the clinic's hit list as a former member of the Sultan of Oman's armed forces. The Feathermen meanwhile arranged for John Smythe, an active watchdog, and a team of local volunteers to mount around-the-clock surveillance of Marmon. The clinic had then to decide how to dispose of Major Marmon. After considerable argument between members of the gang, it was decided to dispatch him in a road accident. Mayer, the technical member, had already perfected the Boston Brakes method in America. This involved fitting a sophisticated device to the brakes of a lead car, controlled by radio from a following car and steering it into the victim's vehicle traveling in the opposite direction. It had worked before in the States and Mayer saw no reason why it should not work again. While Mayer's technical skill was undeniable, the gang recruited another member, Jake, a genius with cars and unethical devices. The gang leased an old disused airstrip in Kent and began to assemble the necessary tools and equipment to modify the brakes of the lead car. The plan began to take shape. First, Marmon had to be caught alone on an open road. "It is lucky," said Mayer, "that Marmon's car is a very small Citroen 2CV which will crack open like an egg when it is hit." A day well ahead was chosen, after a study of Marmon's diary and maps. Tuesday, 11 November, when Marmon was due to visit an old friend, General Robin Brockbank, at Steeple Langford in Wiltshire. He should be driving back after lunch along the A303 at about 3:15 p.m. in time to reach his house in Clapham just before dark. "If we allow him an average speed of 55 miles per hour, he will be comma," said Mayer, pointing to the map, "somewhere along this dual carriageway between Winterbourne Stoke and Popham. If this plan does not work the first time, we will continue to look for a suitable time and place until it does. All we need now," Mayer continued, "is to find a driver who is scheduled to head west on that same stretch at about 3:30 p.m. That should not be too difficult, since the A303 is the main arterial road between London and Plymouth. What sort of person uses that route?" Mayer asked and then answered the question himself, "A representative of a company with offices in both places." "Do you remember," Mayer went on, "that hovercraft we bought from M.L. Slingsby last year for that smuggling job? I have discovered that the holding company owns a subsidiary, M.L. Engineering, in Plymouth, and after a lot of research, I have also found out that M.L. Holdings are having a main board meeting in Plymouth on the morning of 12 November. I have looked at a number of alternative companies and for one reason or another have discounted them. Here is a list of four non-executive directors who will attend the meeting. I have picked out the most likely candidate, Sir Peter Horsley, who lives at Houghton, near Starkbridge, and is likely to use the A303 on his journey to Plymouth, so Jake and I will pay him a little visit." Shortly after this meeting, Jake and Mayer quietly broke into Sir Peter's office above a garage close to the house in the dead of night. They found his diary open on his desk and it took only a few minutes to photograph the relevant pages before they left again, making sure that there were no traces of their visit. On the way out they passed an open garage. They went in and found a large saloon car and Jake made a quick inspection of it, a BMW 728i automatic, registration 3545 bh, Michelin 15 tires. This was undoubtedly the ideal car for their purposes. The two returned to the disused airstrip and the next day they purchased a second-hand BMW 728i and two target practice cars. Jake fitted the control system to the BMW and rehearsals began in earnest. It was decided that Mia and Jake should follow the BMW and De Villiers, another member of the gang, would follow Marmon's 2CV. All was now set. They perfected the equipment and procedures just 2 days before the target date. On the night of Monday, 10 November, five members of the gang assembled outside Sir Peter's secluded Victorian house in the village of Houghton. Three remained on watch while Jake and Maya began the work of fixing the apparatus to the BMW's braking system, making sure that it could be easily detached after the accident. It took a little time, but eventually they were satisfied with their work. Maya knew from experience that once he had taken over the control of Horsley's car, he could steer it as he pleased. If Horsley survived the crash, all he could say was that his car had not obeyed his steering instruction and had gone out of control. He would have no reason to suspect that his brakes had been tampered with. Maya and Jake positioned themselves in the lane outside Horsley's house on Tuesday morning, ready to follow him when he left for Plymouth. Their victim came out of his house at exactly 2:30 p.m. and, unaware of the drama to be played ahead, got into his car and drove away. Maya and Jake slotted in behind him at a comfortable distance and followed him discreetly on to the A303. Smythe, who had followed Marmon to Steeple Langford and then, after lunch, down the A303, soon became aware of a white Ford Escort driven by De Villiers that siphoned in behind Marmon's small Citroen. Before Maya and Jake reached the Amesbury roundabout, the voice of De Villiers broke in on the CB radio, 2CV making a steady 70 miles per hour. Has just passed the A360 turn off. Maya consulted the calculator and reckoned that Marmon would be driving down the dual carriageway in about 3 minutes. The Volvo accelerated to a position just behind Horsley and Maya turned his special radio equipment to the on position. De Villiers' voice came over again. One car behind me, otherwise clear ahead. Activate the brake device any time now. Maya took over Horsley's car and the gyrations began. He steered the BMW across the center of their reservation into the path of Marmon's approaching car and then accelerated past the disappearing BMW. Jake pulled up about 500 yards further on and they both got out of the Volvo in time to see the death throes of the two cars. They then drove off to make the rendezvous in Andover with De Villiers. De Villiers had in the meantime watched Horsley being taken off in the ambulance and waited for the two wrecked cars to be transported to a garage close to Amesbury before driving on to Andover to meet the rest of the gang. That night, two members of the clinic broke into the garage and quickly removed all the apparatus from Horsley's car. The police arrived the following morning and their limited inspections revealed nothing technically wrong with either of the two cars. They did not have the slightest suspicion that they had been duped. Chapter 2, A Miserable Start. On entering the front door of my house, I was faced by the hall, dark and threatening, with odd pieces of furniture scattered around in an appalling muddle. I was born in 1921 in one of the grander houses in West Hartlepool to a wealthy family of timber merchants and shipowners. West Hartlepool may not be very well known today, but 100 years ago it was a town of some importance. Durham was once described as a lump of coal with 1.5 million people clinging to it. In the last century there were 150 pits and 58 iron ore works and blast furnaces in the county. All this industry required construction, communications and a large port to support it. My family exploited all three with timber to prop up the coal faces and ships to carry the coal through the port of West Hartlepool. My forebears were seafarers who in the drive of the Industrial Revolution became early entrepreneurs. The school song of the Royal Grammar School at Newcastle upon Tyne records their rise, Horsley. A merchant venturer bold of good Northumbrian strain, founded our rule, and built our school in bluff King Harry's reign, long shall his name old time defy, like the castle grim that stands, foursquare to every wind that blows, in our stormy northern lands. Forter to defend its triumphance, my parents lived a life of the very rich with cars, servants and long bouts of travelling in the Middle East and Europe. In between times my mother managed to bear 7 children, beginning with my eldest brother, Terence, in 1904 and finishing off with myself, as an afterthought, in 1921. We were reared almost exclusively by Nanny Thomas, a lady of great loyalty, authority and affection, aided by a succession of governesses and nursery maids, and only paraded before my parents on special occasions. My father was a junior partner in the family business. He was a fine athlete and sportsman, a competent painter and author of several travel books. My mother was a tall, handsome woman of considerable artistic and musical ability and an accomplished angler as well. They must have made a striking couple as they traveled around the world, talented and rich. I have written this in no spirit of boastfulness, but rather to give some yardstick against which to measure the depths of the black hole that awaited me. During the Great War, the family fortunes grew, sustained by government contracts for pit props and ships. Whether it was the excitement of the war or the ambitions of a younger son to prove that he was as good a businessman or better than his elders, my father began to speculate in a number of risky ventures. Like so many speculators both before and since, he did not need the money, as the family business provided more than enough to sustain their substantial lifestyle. I was christened Beresford Peter Torrington. My given names provided a source of embarrassment for the rest of my life. They certainly did not match my subsequent poverty-stricken youth. From the time I was able to impress my will upon others, I insisted on the Christian name of Peter. Unfortunately, institutions require knowledge of such names, so that at the Dragon School, my preparatory school in Oxford, I was at first called Beresford, shortened to Berry, until I fought my way back to Peter again. This lasted until, years later, the Air Ministry publicly announced the appointment as equerry to HRH the Princess Elizabeth and Duke of Edinburgh of Flight Lieutenant Beresford Horsley, although my friends still called me Peter. The Beresford stuck with me like a leech until I left the palace as a wing commander some years later. The final injury was inflicted when I was knighted and asked whether I wished to be dubbed Sir Beresford. This brought a lovely thought - bad Sir Beresford - but I grimly stuck to Peter. The inevitable crash occurred in 1922 when the whole family edifice collapsed. My eldest brother, Terence, returning from rugby school, found my father in the stables at the back of our house, dead from a gunshot wound. He was still only 42. My earliest memories were of family discord and insecurity. Unpleasant events occurred to which I was not party, yet I was aware of the great unhappiness they caused to those closest to me. It seemed at the time that everything I cared for or trusted was removed. Following the crash, the elders of our tribe closed ranks and bought off any scandal by settling my father's huge debts. The gunshot wound was put down to an accident. The cars were sold and the servants, except for Nanny, were dismissed. Terence was made to leave rugby, but the rest of my brothers were allowed to stay on at their public schools. The family were paid off with an allowance of £2,000 per year, a generous sum in those days, provided that we all left West Hartlepool, never to return. A small suburban house was purchased in Newcastle upon Tyne and we all crowded into it, my mother by this time a sick woman, whose unhappiness had pushed her into drinking too much, together with Nanny, 4 large and boisterous boys, 2 girls and finally a small boy, myself. 44 Sharnderson Road was a tall, narrow terrace house next to a vicarage in the very respectable backwater suburb of Newcastle called Jesmond. The vicar and our immediate neighbours must have been astonished at the arrival of our circus in a fleet of taxis, delivering all the above plus 3 Pekingese and a great assortment of boxes and drunks. My mother could never get out of the habit of travelling in the grand style. The house was furnished with pieces salvaged from the past which were totally out of place in such surroundings. By now my mother seldom left her bed except to be taken out 2 or 3 times a week in an oversized bath chair wheeled by a hired man. I looked forward to these excursions and can still savor the exquisite scent of my mother's expensive furs. On such occasions I was placed in the foot of the bath chair on a fur rug, curled up with the three Pekingese who from time to time would jump out and lap the chair, yapping and barking, before jumping back on again. Thus this extraordinary procession proceeded down Chanderson Road into Acorn Road with its few shops, watched by many curious eyes from behind their suburban curtains. It is little wonder that parents would not allow their children to play with me, and our house was off limits to them. The wooden garage, at the rear of the house and backing onto a lane, contained a large square upright Austin. This was only wheeled out once a year, for our annual holiday at the seaside. I believe this annual outing was an important symbol to my mother of her will to keep us together as a family. A house was rented on the front at Cullercoats, a small fishing village between Tynemouth and Whitley Bay. The Austin was packed with every conceivable item of luggage, and together with bodies and animals we set off with myself, Nanny and the Pekingese in the front seat and my mother driving. The short journey to the coast was extremely hazardous, accompanied by the shouts of irate motorists and gesticulating pedestrians, as my mother had only a very rudimentary idea of the gears and brakes and absolutely no idea whatever of the rules of the road. Fortunately, she was completely oblivious to traffic lights. These holidays were my most treasured memories. Paddling with Nanny in the shallows, donkey rides at Tynemouth, chipping limpets off the side of the quay for bait, followed by delicious fishing expeditions in a brightly colored boat hired for the afternoon, baiting hooks, and the excitement of pulling in the struggling mackerel and whiting. Shortly after arriving in Jesmond, I was introduced into the local convent school. Well groomed and dressed in a sailor suit which my mother thought proper to the occasion, I was escorted daily to this establishment at the end of Osborne Road. In this garb I became a figure of great merriment to the other children, but soon earned their respect and admiration by concealing white mice under my ample nautical collar. This would finally cause my rapid expulsion when one day the mice, now swollen in numbers, jumped ship and soon had the nuns scuttling about clutching their skirts, shrieking and seeking refuge on chairs and desks. My sailor suit was thankfully consigned to the dustbin and I was sent instead to a small day school called Ackhurst's, where the discipline and supervision were a good deal stricter. This period of order and contentment was not to continue for very long before my first prop was knocked away. Nanny, who had been with the family for over 20 years, suddenly departed. She was there 1 minute and gone the next. Whether her departure was due to a lack of money or a clash with my mother I never learned, although I suspect the latter, since in West Hartlepool Nanny had been used to her own establishment, whereas in Chanderson Road there was only overcrowding. At any rate, she went to work for another fine old family from our past, the Places of Northallerton. Occasionally I was permitted to go and visit her and was soon made aware of the difference in my status. I rarely saw the parents, only Nanny, the children and the servants. During these visits I was treated with kindness and put somewhere in the middle of the nursery hierarchy, below the children of the house but above the servants. This was my first introduction to the social pecking order and I learned the meaning of pride. I was nearly 6 when the second and main prop in my life followed the first and the roof caved in. One early morning I was woken up by my eldest brother and told that instead of going to school that day I was to go and stay at Witton Grange, a family friend's country house at Rothbury. Number 44 Chanderson Road was uncannily quiet and I had a dreadful feeling of foreboding, although at the same time gladly accepting the offer of truancy from school. When the Watson's car and chauffeur arrived, I asked to say goodbye to my mother but was told she was too sick to see me. I had not seen very much of her recently since she had progressively spent more time in bed and less in her bath chair. Some 10 days later I was returned to Chanderson Road by the same chauffeur-driven car to be informed that my mother had gone away to stay with Nanny and it was left to the boy next door to tell me the brutal truth as he stuck his tongue out and shouted over the wall, "Yah, your mum's dead." None of my family ever referred to her again, how she died or where she was buried, and I never asked. While I had Nanny and my mother alive, the other occupants of the house were rather shadowy figures. With her death, they began to focus much more sharply. Suddenly my eldest brother, Terence, became the dominant figure in the household. While my mother lived, the family somehow held together as a unit, but on her death all restrictions were removed and we reverted to becoming individuals. Terence, the three boys aged 24, 21 and 19 respectively, my sisters aged 13 and 10 and, well down the pecking order, my six-year-old self. The boys were big, boisterous and strong, so the house became a battleground for the best bed, the first bath and the final piece of toast at breakfast. The house itself changed character. My mother had her own bedroom and the drawing room next door as her sitting room, and Terence, now very much head of the family, occupied a large study on the ground floor. All the rest of us, including Nanny, had seemed to fit in quite comfortably in the remaining space. Strangely enough, when my mother died the house seemed to get smaller and there was less rather than more room, possibly because, with the restrictions removed, my brothers and sisters began to fill the house with their friends. My eldest sister attempted to manage the housekeeping with an impressive portfolio of envelopes all marked with the appropriate tradesman, greengrocer, butcher and so forth, and money was switched from one to the other according to the particular crisis of the day and substituted with paper IOUs. I never failed to be impressed by this first introduction to high finance. She was aided in looking after the house by a succession of hard-faced housekeepers, paid only enough to be civil but not enough to stop them terrorizing a small boy if the occasion arose. According to the state of the envelopes, we sometimes had a living inmaid as well. Years afterwards I began to comprehend my eldest brother's difficulties. On my father's death he had been forced to leave Rugby and assume his position as male head of the family under extremely unpleasant circumstances, salvaging what he could from the mess and finally moving us from West Hartlepool to Newcastle while the rest of his brothers continued their education. With the death of our mother, he was really thrown in at the deep end at an age when all his energies should have been directed into his own career and interests. He was precast in the role of villain, a role which he filled very successfully. Although we all lived in the same house, Terence managed to isolate himself from the day-to-day problems and the study became his private domain from which he ruled autocratically. My other brothers and sisters were, no doubt, unruly, and without him there would have been no discipline at all. Even with him, there was not very much. People came in and out of the house at will, and meals were irregular. To an outsider it must have appeared like a pride of cubs bereft of their elders, quarreling over the scraps. I learned the art of survival by keeping out of the way. The study and its occupant were the center of my fear. If I was caught doing something wrong, I was summoned to the study and justice was administered on the spot, a beating either with an ivory riding switch with an ornate golden handle which hung on the study wall, no doubt a trophy my parents had brought back from their travels, or even more lethal, with an épée which resided in an elephant's foot in the hall alongside an assortment of walking sticks. My brother knew exactly how hard he could beat me without inflicting any lasting damage, an art probably learned as a prefect at Rugby. I discovered the importance of not stifling tears. Crying indicated to him that I had absorbed the lesson and had submitted to his will. My sisters occasionally stuck up for me and were often beaten as well for their trouble. However, provided I kept to the basic rules and stayed out of his way, I was conveniently forgotten. I had none of the usual children's toys such as soldiers, trains and so on to play with, and the peculiar circumstances of our household had not encouraged the making of friends. More and more I took to the streets and my games were extremely sophisticated. I became an explorer and the back streets of Newcastle, derelict sites and old empty houses my territory. I climbed nearly every wall and roof in our street, and the results of these forays were both dangerous and painful. Often I would return home with torn clothes and broken skin to be duly beaten. What friends I made were picked up casually in the course of my wanderings, and they were usually street urchins. Urchin is not such a common word now as it was then, and I still recall peering through the railings of the local council school and watching the young children of about my own age romping in the playground. The difference was that I had shoes and stockings while many of them were barefooted. Occasionally I was picked up and joined a gang roaming the streets terrorizing the shopkeepers, but this was always a very temporary liaison.